and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr. Thanks for taking time to be with us tonight. Tonight I have with us Dr. Albert Mensah, and we're going to talk about methylation, histamine mast cell disorder, heavy metals, under-over-methylation, mastocytosis, autoimmune disease tonight. We've been talking about that for quite some time, but we're going to try to branch out a little bit and talk about some other things rather than just MTHFR. So welcome, Dr. Mensah. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. Thank you very much.
So before we get started, would you just take a couple minutes and tell us who you are, what you do, and where people can find you? And maybe even, if it's not too much, how you came to do what you're doing with genetics or methylation, whatever you want to call it.
Well, my name is Dr. Albert Mensah. I am functionally, I'm a biochemical imbalance specialist. By original training, I was a family practice physician, which is a specialty involving everything, including pediatrics, geriatrics, women's health, internal medicine, pretty much the gamut except for major surgery. We're located in actually a town called Warrenville, Illinois, which is only about 20 miles outside of Chicago. And our office number is telephone number 630-256-8308. It's really a long story as to how I got in this field. I just want to tell everyone listening that I was a bona fide skeptic of any kind of therapy outside of traditional medicine. I still am a skeptic in general about most things, but I was fortunate to have a very close friend in medical school who stumbled upon this kind of a methodology and began working with the original Pfeiffer Treatment Center, now closed, and came to me at a time when I had a choice of making a lot of money in traditional medicine or branching off into this field. And after I literally saw for myself with my own eyes individuals doing better and getting healed, literally, with disorders that had formerly been labeled as like schizophrenia and autism and ADHD and anxiety and depression without any medication whatsoever to be used on the part of the center. I saw this repeatedly happening, not just once or twice. It couldn't have been, you know, a guesswork or an accident. There was actually an actual process that was used to help people mend and do well. And we're not talking about a few people. The vast majority, more than 85%, did extremely well. And after viewing this, there was no way I could deny that anymore. So that's how I got into this field. And that was quite a few years ago. So we're still doing this, and now we are a preacher of this field and a teacher in addition to a practitioner. So many people say seeing is believing. I have seen. So that's how I got here.
Well, I applaud you, and thank you for doing it. It's really hard for people to find somebody that knows anything other than writing them a prescription for these problems today. So I'm a friend of Bill Walsh, and we've had Bill several times. In fact, we had him last week, so I was hoping kind of to use you to extend outside the interview that we did with Bill last week, where we talked about, you know, just typical hypermethylation and typical symptoms of metal overloads. And so I'd like to ask you to start with autoimmune disorders, perhaps, or histamine mast cell disorder with copper zinc. I'd like to start there because we didn't get time to go through that last week or week before last with Bill. Was that all right with you?
Certainly. I'd like to have a little bit more of a specific concept around what it is you'd like me to address, though.
Well, you know what? You've got some free reign. Here's what I want to cover. I'd like to cover autoimmune and gut if we don't cover anything else. So if you have something that you typically like, do you have a speech that you talk about about those areas? How to restore gut, how to repair autoimmune, how to know if you over-methylate, how do you know if it's methylation versus histamine, mast cell disorder? Where would someone start if they walked in with those issues right there, gut and autoimmune?
those are very, very broad categories. First of all, I'd like to say that Bill Walsh is my mentor. He is the one who's responsible for us being here today. I trained under him and under the entire team of medical practitioners at the original Fiber Treatment Center, now closed. I'm really grateful to Dr. Walsh and to his mentor, Dr. Carl Pfeiffer, the man who was the pioneer in this field. When someone comes into the office with a discussion of autoimmune disorders or dysregulation, as we call it, that is, where the immune system starts to fight against itself, there can really be a plethora of causes that really sort of sit quite truly even outside of the realm of methylation. Now, while there may be a connection, the direct cause may be something very, very different. So if someone has a methylation disorder and an autoimmune disorder, correcting the methylation does not necessarily mean that you're going to correct the autoimmune issue. And we've dealt with that quite often in our office. And so what I'd like to share with people is that you need to consider that any autoimmune disorder that you may have, whether it's a thyroiditis or whether it's Graves' disease or whether it's that is with a thyroid or whether it's something related to regular immune health, sometimes combined immunodeficiencies that result from autoimmune disorders or challenges come into play. And correcting methylation does not actually fix those. The most important thing that any doctor wants for a patient, of course, is for them to get well. And in order for that to happen, you have to know really what correlates with what causes what, and how you address them. So it's
Let me insert something important here that I forgot. I'm sorry. Even though Dr. Mintz is a medical doctor, I just want to make it clear that he's not attempting to treat or diagnose anyone on here, that the information that he's providing is just that, information. Please go and see your personal health care provider if you have any issues or questions about your health related to what he's talking about. Sorry, I just wanted to make sure we got that in.
Oh, thank you. That was very important, actually.
Yeah, it is. Sorry about that.
No problem. There are one of the things that's very interesting about autoimmune disorders is that quite often they tend to be triggered by some type of outside insult. Okay. Now, I say that because methylation is an internal disorder. It's usually genetic or epigenetic in origin. So you're kind of born with it, and you're waiting for the right insult to happen in life or group of insults leading to a trigger that shifts your methylation challenges here. Autoimmune issues are often caused by some type of virus, some type of metal or toxic exposure, sometimes even trauma of some type can cause autoimmune issues. Now, once those issues are brought into fruition, that is, the condition shows itself, quite rarely is it truly the place where treating the methylation aspect will actually correct the autoimmune issue. So you cannot substitute methylation treatment or protocols for dealing with the autoimmune phenomenon. So I just really wanted to kind of make that very clear. In most cases.
Then I guess my next question would be, we've spent many interviews on methylation. What if we use a portion of this interview to talk about autoimmune then?
Yes. When you look to correct autoimmune challenges and you want to bring methylation into the fray, now, there are a couple of things that can happen. People can be either what's called under-methylated or over-methylated, or they can actually be normal in methylation. And I really want to stress to everyone listening, most people walking this planet are actually normal in methylation. There's so much buzz on the internet, and we get a lot of questions from people all over the place about methylation, and I took this genetic test, and it shows that I don't properly methylate. That's not necessarily true. When you have an insult in, say, even you spoke of the MTHFR test, for example, when you have a gene insult, you're heterozygous or even homozygous, there are a lot of factors and variables that affect whether or not that genetic challenge turns into an actual problem for you as an individual. Okay. there are plenty of individuals walking around who are homozygous. That is, they've got two genetic insults in the MTHFR enzyme, the methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase enzyme, and they're perfectly fine. They actually methylate quite well. What I need to emphasize for everyone out there is that that enzyme is only one of several enzymes involved in what is called cumulative methylation. Let's go back for one quick moment, please, so that we can define what methylation actually is.
Okay.
Methylation is a process. Okay, it is a process. When you look at, going back to general chemistry class way back when, a carbon molecule with a carbon atom, sorry, connected to three or four hydrogen atoms. Just like water is H2O, methyl is CH3, a carbon with three or four hydrogens. That molecule is like a Lego. It attaches to other molecules like enzymes, like hormones, and like neurotransmitters. And when it attaches to those molecules, it will either turn them on, that is, activate them, or turn them off, which is to deactivate them. Now, the process, when that methyl molecule attaches and does its work, that's called methylation. Okay, that's all methylation is. Methylation is when a methyl molecule adds on to another molecule. Now, you know where there's methylation, there's demethylation, when a methyl molecule is removed. So now, if we're going to have methylation, that is a process whereby you add one methyl molecule onto another molecule, then that means that you've got to have a certain amount of methyl made. So methyl has to be present in actual concentrations. Now, many people may not produce enough methyl, and these are the folks we call under-methylated. There are some folks out there who produce way too many methyl, and those are folks we call over-methylated. Now, the key here to that I really want to bring up is because is that you can be under-methylated and function just perfectly well. You can be over-methylated and function just perfectly well. But the more under-methylated you become, or are rather, and the more over-methylated you become, the more troubles start to come in. Like with under-methylation, you might see ADHD, anxiety, depression, and in very worst states, addictive tendencies, drugs, alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. With over-methylation, you might start to see things like also anxiety and depression, but more so the very, very deep, dark depressions, the areas of bipolar disorder-type symptoms. A lot of these things are related to having too much methyl. Now, what's very key is that there are a lot of tests out there that supposedly talk about under-methylation, but there are no tests out there that directly, genetic tests, I'm speaking about genetic tests, there are no real genetic tests that talk about over-methylation. So, see, if you're not testing for all the enzymes that affect over-methylation and all the enzymes that affect under-methylation, you really can't get a good picture as to whether or not a person is in total normally methylating, under-methylating, or over-methylating. That's the piece of those genetic tests don't cover. And a lot of people, including a lot of doctors, really don't know that. I'm fortunate and blessed because my mentor is one of the world's leading experts in methylation, but he's also a biochemist. And from that point, he looks at things very differently than certainly the traditional physician does. And so he gleans out sort of the errors and the shortcomings of many tests and procedures by looking at the actual molecular nature of what's going on. So having said all that, though, now that we understand there are many people who are normally methylating, many people who are under-methylating, and many people who are over-methylating, the way we test for it is actually a blood test. A simple histamine test can actually tell you if you are in total making too much methyl, making too little methyl, or whether you're normally methylating. Okay? Now, having understood that or having stated that, when we talk about disorders of the autoimmune nature, the question may arise as to whether or not there is a methylation issue. There can be parallel methylating disorders that do not directly affect autoimmune issues. In other words, fixing the methylation won't correct the autoimmune challenge. Now, I want to say this very clearly. In some cases, the methylation problem, if someone is undermethylated, truly undermethylated, they can't activate some of those defense mechanisms that are involved in autoimmunity. Or if they're overmethylated, they might be overstimulating some of those enzymes, hormones, or neurotransmitters that actually might be involved in an autoimmune phenomenon. Okay. So both sides can exist here, and yet they are still the minority. I want to be very clear about that. Most of the time there's an autoimmune presence or challenge, it's not really correlated to a methylation issue such that when you correct methylation, the autoimmune problem disappears.
Okay. So where do you start with autoimmune?
With autoimmune, well, actually differentiating where the problem lies, in other words, in which organ system does the problem lie, is key. Because most of the time, from what we've seen, so many people travel these days, so many people are exposed to many cultures, many lands, many territories, that it's very hard to isolate where a given insult came from. It could be a virus, it could be a bacteria, it could be toxic fumes that people may get from, nail salons, believe it or not. One of the most interesting things is, and sad things, is that some of the very owners of beauty parlors and nail salons, because of their chronic exposure to chemicals, they've come down with things like autoimmune issues and cancer even. Now, this doesn't mean the person who goes to the center casually, but we're talking about the people who work there day in and day out and their chemical exposure. Mm-hmm. So sometimes a very, very important piece of this is looking at the history. Was there a chemical exposure that triggered this? Did people travel? Did they have a virus, a flu? Many people talk about cold-like symptoms, flu-like symptoms. They had a very, very bad period of weakness and vomiting and all sorts of things that just lasted for a very, very long time. And then they just had chronic fatigue for months thereafter. Something usually triggered that event. And so a good history is the place to start. Now, after that, you've got to determine which systems are involved. That is it the thyroid? Is it the adrenal gland? Is it some other part of what we call the endocrine system, a system that produces hormones? Is it that the person's immune system itself is fighting multiple areas of the human body? Okay. Usually the immune system picks one particular area, like, as I said, it attacks the thyroid gland. Sometimes it attacks the pancreas. That's a little bit more rare. Sometimes it affects or attacks other areas in the body. But diagnosing what's being attacked is really the most important step out of all those things. And then after that, you've got to determine how to treat it. So unfortunately, treatment is very specific to which system is being affected. So we can't really speak to the particular type of treatment during, of course, this conversation today, but the idea is, first of all, detecting where the problems lie, and then looking to approach the challenge of solution and treatment. Now, with regard to, if you don't mind, the whole idea of digestive issues and gut problems, okay, gut problems are also quite important and quite prevalent, especially in the autism community. But we see them not just in autism, but in many other disorders as well, and adult individuals as well. Now, there's a whole spectrum of challenges that occur there, some related to methylation, some not. But with regard to the gut, one of the most important things that folks have to really do is to give a good history. In other words, take note for yourself. What type of gut problems do you have? Do you have malabsorption? Do you have chronic diarrhea? Do you have constipation? Do you have bowel pain? Do you have bowel pain when you're eating, for example, or does the bowel pain come afterwards? Does a particular foodstuff cause diarrhea? One of the very important tests that somebody can do is a food allergy panel or food allergy sensitivity. One of the best tests for that is called the ALICAT test. And that test, I believe Doctor's Data does it, but that's a very, very good test that tells you which specific foods you might be either allergic to or sensitive to. I have a very interesting story, just personally related here. One of my family members used to have headaches every single day, well, at least 3 or 4 times a week, I should say. And she's an older sibling. And all of our lives, her favorite food was the food I couldn't stand the most in life. It was spinach. And my mother, of course, would try to please everyone and make, you know, everyone's favorite food every couple of days or periodically. And I just found out literally yesterday that she had a food allergy sensitivity panel done, the ALICAT test. She found out she was allergic to spinach.
Really?
And when, yes. And when she and her husband stopped eating spinach, of course he did it because he's a loving husband. When she stopped eating spinach, her headaches disappeared. She hadn't had a headache for literally 4 months since stopping spinach. Now, I've been on the phone with many doctors. I mean, I grew up with this lady here, and I consulted her. We said, okay, you've got migraine headaches, you've got cluster headaches, you've got sinus headaches, and you've got menstrual migraine headaches. And then you've got the average everyday headache all wrapped up. We don't know which one is causing which at which particular point in time. Lots of drugs, lots of medications. She never got better. And lo and behold, all these years later, now we find out it was caused by spinach. Can you believe that one?
That's very...
And it is, well, it is true.
That's something kind of... It's similar but different, but I would like to tell you, since you're a physician and you help people, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
Abram Hoffer was one of my friends. That's actually how I met Bill.
Oh, the great Dr. Hoffer. Wonderful. Okay.
Yeah. And... He told me so many times over the years, you know, nicotinic acid, niacin is so safe. You know, it's the best statin there is. Well, years later, I developed, I had a heart attack, and a few years later, I balanced everything. I had my fatty acids, because I would do all the testing every 3 months. I'd do all these testing. The only thing I had left was my triglycerides. So about maybe 9 months ago, I started taking therapeutic dosages of nicotinic acid, like 4 grams a day. And my triglycerides came down, but mm-hmm. I developed lipomas all over my body, and I've suddenly, and I don't know if it's connected or not, got terrible, well, I won't say terrible, I don't have any idea how it is, but I have autoimmune. I can see it on the test. So I'm wondering, you know, it's so important for people to understand vitamins or medicine. And you can't just take one of them. You know, that's why I got myself in trouble by playing with that and just taking one thing and getting something out of balance somewhere. But it's what made me think that I wanted to do autoimmune, because I started talking about it to people, and I got all these emails from people saying that, you know, they had fatty lipomas all over them, or now they've suddenly got autoimmune. So I just wanted to, how do you start? Mine also came with terrible gut problems. Every time I eat something, I get this bloating and this bile stuff, and I don't know. I just wanted to help other people deal with this thing.
Now let's talk about that one, because the bloating thing happens a lot to many people. So what does that mean? If we're certain foods, certain drinks, certain carbonated drinks can cause an increase in gas production. Remember, in our bowel, we've got lots of bacteria. And our bacteria are designed, or the bacteria in there is designed to actually break down our foodstuffs. Some of the elements that get broken down can actually cause the production of gas. So literally, the bacteria in our gut can produce gas that over time causes that bloating and that fullness. Okay? So looking at that as one piece, in other words, what are some of the elements we're eating that might cause these gas-producing entities to build up and go overtime on us? That's one thing. The other side, of course, now, and so doing a good dietary history and keeping a journal of what you eat when you've got this bloated feeling is very important. Now, when we talk about pain when you eat, if it's pain when you sort of swallow before it really sort of sits in your stomach, you also have to consider if there are any structural abnormalities in the esophagus, such as what we would call a hernia, a hiatal hernia, where the the little sphincter that controls, little muscle that controls what the food gets from your esophagus to your stomach, is normally functioning, or if it's problematic and not functioning very well. Now, if it's not functioning very well, you can get a lot of gas that comes from the stomach up into the esophagus and cause heartburn. Okay. So one of the questions many people ask is, do you have heartburn? Now, I want to shift for a moment. We were talking about histamine. I want to talk about the histamine that's in foods, because a lot of people get this confused. The histamine that's in foods gets broken down by a different system than the histamine that's in your brain. Okay? The histamine that's in foods gets broken down by an enzyme called diamine oxidase, or DAO. That enzyme in our system, in our bodies, is directly responsible for breaking down the histamine in food. There's a small percentage of people, probably about 7 to 10%, that are actually deficient in that enzyme. So when they eat, they have pain in their bodies. And so, quite interestingly, this is not a hard one to treat. You get this test, the DAO test, and by the way, everyone out there, I own no stock in this stuff, so I don't want anyone to think I'm trying to push this. This is purely informative. If you have a deficiency in diamine oxidase and you eat foods that are rich in histamines, yes, you will have pain when you eat. So literally taking the enzyme, no drugs, not even any nutrients in this case, taking the enzyme, diamine oxidase, comes in a little pill, I believe it comes in a liquid, relieves that pain. And so you've cleared yourself of a problem that just aggravates so many people. Now, the other side is, if you find out that you're lacking that enzyme, you may want to decrease your exposure to foods rich in histamine. But how many people are going to take out tomatoes from their lifestyle? It's in ketchup, okay? You're going to eat a hot dog or a hamburger. It's in tomatoes. It's in, you know, a lot of things. So being aware of some of the potential reasons for your bowel pain is hugely important. For example, some people may have, a lot of people will talk about ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease or inflammatory bowel disorder or IBS, inflammatory bowel syndrome, as many people call it. They'll often have pain, bloating, diarrhea, and constipation that kind of alternates. It makes eating such a difficult experience. And how much of our social lives are actually designed around food? Someone graduates, somebody has a happy day, we go out to eat, to celebrate. And usually when somebody with IBS goes anywhere, the first thing they're doing is looking for where the bathroom is located. Okay, that makes for an uncomfortable lifestyle. So it's important, if you have those kind of symptoms, you know, the bloating, the alternating diarrhea, constipation, you know, look to your primary physician to find out if you've got IBS. There's also the consideration of whether or not you may have an ulcer. These are some of the baseline old school things. You know, a peptic ulcer or even an H. pylori. It's a bacteria. Helicobacter pylori, H. pylori, is an element that produces ulcers, a certain type of ulcer in peptic ulcer disease. So after people eat, they can have pain, and many of them will be considered as having ulcers. But a simple test, nowadays it's actually, I believe it's a breath test. There's also a blood test available for H. pylori. I bring up H. pylori because when you find out you've got it, it's treatable, although with antibiotics, a triple regimen. But when you're done, this thing is gone, and so is your pain. So there are a variety of, it's really a huge subject, just a variety of different elements that can cause you pain with your meal. And it's important to really sort of look to keep a journal, keep track of when this actually happens. So many different possibilities. Once again, it could be something as rare as a diamine oxidase deficiency. It could be IBS. It could be peptic ulcer disease, including bacteria like H. pylori. You could have picked up a bug if you went camping, okay, and had an amoeba sitting in your system that causes regular diarrhea. Not regular, but it's a vicious, sometimes bloody diarrhea.
Wow.
So there are many ways to look at this particular phenomenon. Now, having gone through that sort of a segment, then we kind of look at where are some of the more difficult challenges that are often correlated with mental health. Okay. Individuals who've had bowel challenges because of genetic abnormalities. Children in the autism spectrum have malabsorption. Individuals with a great deal of autoimmune issues may also suffer from malabsorption. And part of the key here is that the actual structure of the tube we call your gut, that which is meant to absorb and at the same time excrete certain elements into your system, it's not a solid tube the way it should be. It's like it's got little holes in there. And those little holes represent areas where that part of the bowel simply can't work too terribly well. So many children have what's called a malabsorptive syndrome, in which case they're very small, they're very thin, they're not growing very well, they may have diarrhea, they just may not seem to thrive. Well, if you can't absorb your nutrients, well, all that food and all that eating you're doing isn't doing a whole lot of good. You're basically starving while you eat. Your brain is starving, your rest of your body is starving, yet it looks like you're having a regular meal. The other side is that most of these children will also have diarrhea, or in many cases, they have tremendous constipation. Now, let's talk about, for a minute, tremendous constipation, either in a child and an adult. We have a tube in our systems we call the bowel, the small intestine and the large intestine, that's over 30 feet long if you stretch it out. Now, can you imagine being blocked up in most of that tube that is having at least 15 to 20 meters or 20 feet of blockage of all that bad stuff we call stool? Please remember, in that stool, there's bacteria, there's yeast, there are toxins, and it builds up. And over time, that can also wreak havoc on the bowel wall. So now it's not just the structural blockage we're talking about. Now we're talking about inflammation that occurs in the bowel as a result of it. So once again, when you eat, this may cause a problem with regard to your bowels and your pain in the abdomen because you're trying to force more food into something that's not really moving. Now, many people say, well, listen, I get that, and I feel constipated, but I still have bowel movements. Well, you keep putting food into a tube that's 30 feet long. What you get rid of is being replaced with more stuff to take its place. Okay? So we have to realize that if we don't really have a cleared-out system, especially in children, then we're going to see everything from physical pain to behavior disorders in children. Children who are, you know, under the age of 7 or 8, probably I should say more like 10, who have these blockages in their colon, they're not mature enough to really understand what's going on and to be able to express, well, you know, mother, my colon is rather distended at this point in time. You know, they don't see that. They, in fact, what they do is they tend to act out. Their behavior gets very erratic. They may press themselves up against chairs or up against you because they don't know what to do. They don't even know what really the problem is. And that's only half the issue.
Never thought about that. That's interesting.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mechanical blockage is a very, very big thing with children. The other big part is that now yeast, we've all heard of yeast, yeast build up inside children that are constipated. That yeast is not a pretty phenomenon, and many doctors in traditional medicine really don't know this or acknowledge it, but the yeast issue, yeast produce toxins. Those toxins act like caseomorphines, what we call a caseomorphine. You've heard of morphine, then, that positive high that you get, so to speak, like the morphine drug, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, caseomorphines do the opposite. These things produce that temporary high and then bring you down into this foul, depressive state. Those yeast bugs, so to speak, in your system, in your gut, can produce toxins that produce an exorphin-like effect. Just what I described.
Is that why do they suddenly crave sugar for that? Is that
I'm
why they
glad
do that?
You brought that up. Absolutely. Yeast thrive on sugar. It makes them grow more, and it makes them produce more yeast. And so when you produce more yeast, and they grow, and they produce more yeast, they produce more toxins. So those toxins therefore go into your system, into your mind, into your body, cause that wonderful high and then that crash. I'll be quite honest. Let's talk about me and my youth when I was a child. Boy, summertime was awesome. I used to have Twinkies. I used to have Coca-Cola. And then after a few hours of being just wonderfully high, I kind of come down and crash. And then I want more Coca-Cola. And so the kids in this culture that we live in who are thriving on sugar, 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 and carbs, oh, please, McDonald's, Burger King, any fast food, any burgers, fries, all those things, the pizzas, they are simply food for yeast. So believe it or not, the food you eat or your child eats can translate into behavioral challenges and make your life as a parent more miserable than it needs to be. So one of the things that we advise our parents is, listen, we're going to do a yeast test for your child. If your child comes up positive, here's a list of foods that you need to stop or at least minimize in order to basically starve the yeast while we're treating the yeast. And after we've treated the yeast, then you need to maintain children on usually what is a low-carb diet or a low-starch diet or a low-sugar diet. Sugar feeds yeast. Now, many people are saying, listen, yes, ma'am, go right ahead.
I have two questions. So how would you recommend, and most of my audience is going to be healthcare professionals themselves, holistic healthcare professionals, or either the more knowledgeable adult regarding nutrition. Like, for example, we eat grass-fed, free-range chicken and organic vegetables. Of course, my kid fights me on that. But what would you recommend to someone who has a child doing that to get rid of the yeast? Is it, would you use nystatin, or do you recommend olive leaf, or what would you recommend? And then two, what do you recommend for that child to have a better bowel movement?
Okay, great questions. And in actuality, you brought up one of the elements we use. Now, there are many people who want to try to do things, and forgive me, very naturally. When it comes to children and yeast, I have to tell you, some of these kids that we deal with have been kicked out of 3 or 4 preschools. We don't have time to really sort of try to do this with oregano or caprylic acid as a means of killing the yeast. We will go with a nystatin treatment, which is actually fairly benign, but it does the job for a month or so. And it can be done, you know, up to 3 times for 3 months in direction. We've got some kids who've been on nystatin for up to a year. There are no real problems with that. Some children and some parents elect to go with Diflucan and treat it for 10 days. And then you can use a natural element like oregano or caprylic acid to maintain that in addition to appropriate diet. Now, once again, free range and organic type foods, absolutely wonderful. It's a great idea. But children being who they are, we don't necessarily know what they're doing at school. Yes, ma'am?
It is not easy to get that kid to eat that stuff.
It is not. And, you know, they get to school and they start to trade things and they want to buy the bits from that child's lunch or that child's snack. And, you know, it's difficult to keep them as healthy as we would like. But, you know, when we've got the challenge of yeast, we've got some level of flexibility with how we want to treat it. And then maintaining it, we've got flexibility as well. So for many people, once again, they'll choose something like oregano or caprylic acid to maintain. And then you can kind of go from there with regard to appropriate dietary management. Keeping the carbs low. It doesn't mean that you have to forever limit your child from having anything with carbs. It's going to happen sooner or later. But the key is not to live a lifestyle of being high in the carbs and the starches and things that feed yeast, because you will see a change in behavior in children. In fact, you'll see a change in behavior in children probably about 15, 20 minutes after you give them the high-sugar stuff anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But then it becomes more problematic as time goes on, as yeast builds up. So that's one of the things we're very big on cautioning our parents about, the ones who've got these children that come in with these behavioral issues, poor focus and attention. How many children do we have across the United States now who are diagnosed with ADHD and ADD? we were growing up, I always talk about that. I'm not going to tell my age out there, okay? But in that time period when we were growing up, we hardly even heard of that term. Okay, many people now would say, well, it's overdiagnosed, and there's a point to that. But what is not a fallacy is that our children are having more and more focus and attention difficulties, whether it's truly ADHD, or whether it's dietary in nature, or whether there's a problem such as yeast toxicity in nature. So when somebody's saying, listen, your child isn't paying attention in school, a very simple thing to do is, you know, once they've been examined and so forth, is to simply have a yeast test evaluation done by your primary doctor. That can be a stool test. It can actually be a test that's done through a blood sample. There are a variety of ways to go about it. But here's the deal. It's so treatable. And as opposed to having your child's entire academic career thrown off because they're literally not doing well as early as kindergarten and first and second grade, well, get this taken care of. And if it's the cause, you've got a normal child who can move and produce the way they should be in school and not one that's going to be labeled for the next 21 years of their lives. So
Wow. Looking
at the gut is, I'm glad you brought that up. It's a huge but very, very important topic. And
so what
really
about about 10 minutes. Eight minutes maybe. No, it's okay. I just want to let you know so that you can figure out what else you want to say in that 10 minutes. But you talked about the constipation, so what's the best, other than obviously roughage, but what about minerals? What do you suggest about the, you know, relieving that compacted feces?
There are a variety of ways to go, and this is where you want to talk to your practitioner. I'm going to give you a range. More natural people would like to tend to go with things like magnesium. A magnesium oxide tends to be a very, very good way to relieve what I would say not a horrendous constipation, but a mild to moderate constipation. Some people use magnesium citrate. Others will use different forms of magnesium, but that certainly is one way to go. Now, on the other extreme, elements like Miralax and polyethylene glycol, or PEG, actually one of the key elements in Miralax,
polyethylene glycol, it sounds like a plastic.
It does, but it's not.
Okay.
It's actually an electrolyte solution. Tastes
terrible.
Okay. What they give you when you want to get cleaned, when they have to clean you out to do a colonoscopy or to do a bowel evaluation with a scope.
Okay.
First, they have to clean out your gut, and that's actually what they use. So it's very benign, tastes terrible, but it's benign, but it really gets the job done. So there's a spectrum, there's a range of elements you can use, from magnesium and different salts to the Miralax pharmaceutical type stuff to polyethylene glycol, the heavy-duty stuff. But talking to your primary doctor is the best way to go to determine how to help relieve the constipation. And when that happens, by the way, then you've got to look at the types of foods you're eating so that you don't get constipated or clogged up again. Once again, heavy on the starches, heavy on the breads, heavy on, you know, all those other things, including, you know, large volumes of meat, I have to say, without vegetables, can be a big problem. So, you know, balance is really the key here. And taking things step by step and looking critically at each area is really the key to success.
Okay, we have about 8 minutes left. Is there any specific thing you would really like to talk about? Not, I'll ask you questions if you don't, but if there's something you think is important, I'd love to hear it.
I think we kind of touched upon, I went kind of broad in multiple areas because there are multiple points that we really should talk about. But I'd like to ask what questions you or the audience might have, or you feel the audience, your audience would be very interested in hearing about in the last few minutes.
Well, including myself, and three other people that I've received emails from just in the past 2 days, what about those lipoma things? Why did those suddenly start appearing?
We don't know exactly why they suddenly appear. Now, how they appear is that there's basically some type of epigenetic insult. So this goes back to epigenetics. This is where there's some trigger. And for lipomas, it's often trauma. some type of trauma to a particular area of skin that's associated with a fat globule internally, starts to cause these cells to multiply. Now, the good thing about lipomas is that they're not dangerous, okay, unless they're sitting on a nerve or something like that. For the most part, they're benign tumors. They're just rather troublesome and ugly. And, you know, from that perspective,
fortunate that I can't see mine outside, but I can, but other people can't. But is there, and it came after that niacin, that nicotinic acid. Could that perhaps have triggered it to do that?
That's a very interesting question. I do not have the answer to that. I will tell you what I know, and I'll tell you what I don't know. I don't have the direct answer to that, because usually niacin and niacinamide are used to treat high cholesterol and high fat challenges. Now, the other piece is, we also know that sometimes when you take too much of a given nutrient, that too can cause problems. So while I don't have any statistics on whether or not your lipomas were triggered by high niacin, remember that niacin and niacinamide are both part of systems that influence multiple chemical imbalances and multiple chemical shifts. So niacin, for example, being part of nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, or NAD, NAD, in the system. NAD is responsible for a myriad of biochemical reactions that get triggered. So an excess of that could push things in the wrong direction and possibly contribute to lipoma formation. But I could not say specifically 100% that that was the cause. It may have been a trigger.
It is. It came. Well, I mean, I don't, whether, you know, the trigger or not, it came when I did that. It took a few months, but it came with pain in the legs that people call restless leg. So when I stopped it, that restless leg kind of feeling went away, but I was left with lipoma that I can see them. Other people can't really, but I can.
Now, that's
so I know it's connected somehow.
Do you know if you are an undermethylator or an overmethylator?
Well, I know I have, my parents were third cousins, and I have two MTHFRs from both parents, whatever that means.
Have you done a histamine test?
I did. Well, I'd made the mistake one time of letting somebody talk me into using their alleged very expensive, wonderful vitamins for a mood disorder. And I was doing like 15 of these things a day, only to find out down the road that it was, you know, folic acid, and it made me have a heart attack, made my histamine went off the chart. Now I think it's closer to, you know, a regular, I think it's probably okay. I don't turn red anymore.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I am terribly itchy.
I asked that question because a lot of people who are undermethylated tend to have restless leg syndrome, and they can have a lot of a hyperimmune response due to a massive release of histamine. Okay. Now, by the way, that sort of triggered me here. You mentioned mastocytosis and mast cell degranulation disorder. I want to touch upon those just very briefly.
Okay. I may have to have you back because we've got like 3 minutes. And as you say, I hadn't asked very many questions, and that's not normal for me. So it's just, you have a lot to say, and I want to hear it all. So I hope you'll come back soon.
I absolutely would love to, yes.
Okay, so we got about 3 minutes.
Well,
I just wanted to let you know.
I'm going to change topics totally and say this. Folks who've got anxiety, depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, ADHD, autism, any of those things, and more, do not believe anyone who tells you there is no treatment available for these disorders and all you have left is drugs, drugs, drugs. That is not true. Many of these disorders are rooted in biochemical abnormalities that can be fully treated or, in the worst-case scenario, improved upon better than you are today without the use of pharmaceutical agents. Sometimes you need to stay on the pharmaceutical agents you're on, but you can still do the nutrient therapies in conjunction and improve. And some people, by the way, quite honestly, do need to maintain some level of pharmaceutical treatment along with their nutrient protocols. But here's the key I'm trying to get at. For the longest time, we've been blinded in medicine as to the idea that there are root causes that are treatable with natural substances. But here's the real irony. How do we really develop our drugs? We go off to the Amazon jungles and the jungles all over the world looking for plant or natural sources. Then we break those things down. We figure out where the active ingredient is, and then we create drugs from them. So what does that tell you? It tells you what Carl Pfeiffer's law was and why it's true. For every drug that's out there, there's a natural treatment protocol that can do the same job without having the side effects. So,
thank you.
Well, once again, I'm not saying don't use drugs. That is so far not from the truth. Everyone is individual. Well, what I want to share with you is that there are options out there, and there are ways to go that don't involve solely pharmaceutical agents. Don't accept the idea that you're stuck with anxiety or stuck with depression or stuck with chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia and that you need some type of other agent. There are many ways to go to treat those disorders or those imbalances. That's what I want everyone out there to remember.
All I can say is I can't imagine getting a square peg to fit in a round hole.
You got it.
The body is, you know, you can't put something synthetic in something that's real and hope it's going to fix it. Anyway, I don't want to go off on that tangent, God will. But thank you for being with me. I'm going to call your assistant tomorrow and see if I can get you scheduled for another couple of interviews so we can talk about everything else, if you're willing.
Thank you so much for having me on your program.
Tell us one more time where to find you.
Yes. We are Mensa Medical at Warrenville, Illinois. Our website is www.mensa, that's M-E-N-S-A-H, mensamedical.com. And I'm Dr. Albert Mensa. And send me an email if you have a question or give us a call. Telephone number 630-256-8308. I'd love to talk to you anytime. And our conversations don't cost anything. If someone has a question, I'm more than happy to talk to them.
You're fabulous, Dr. Mensa. Thank you. I'll speak to you soon.
Take care. Thank you
very
much.